it's kidney yolk and we're from Litta, we can't use it. So a guy shoots up back from the audience, and what's with Barton's candy? And the Rav says, no, if it has corn syrup. Well, the next morning, Mr. Barton's and a group of lawyers were right there in Dr. Belkin's office going crazy and threatening the yeshiva with a multi-million dollar suit in the 50s we're talking about. So by Friday, this happened Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, the New York Times had a quarter of page ad that Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik declares that he has full confidence in the supervision of Bartons by the Union of Orthodox Jewish Congregations, and their products can certainly be used without any question on the coming Passover holiday. Obviously, a year later, Bartons stopped using corn syrup. Now, a little kid named Donnie Rothkopf heard this, so of course I said, I can, well, who can use May kidney? Absolutely not. 69, I came in Aliyah, and there was absolutely nothing to eat here. It was like the Pesach that my wife's grandmother, mother used to bemoan the fact that there's more than borscht and beets and potatoes on Pesach. That my wife's family, you know, Chassidish Yidden, borscht, potatoes, and meat, and matzah. That's what they ate on Pesach. So there was nothing to eat here. So I remember talking with a guy, Rabbi Margolis, from the Eid HaRedid. He said, all in Nutzen does, everyone uses, legume derivatives here. So I called the chief rabbi, Rabbi Unterman. How did I have the nerve to call the chief rabbi? Very simple question. I worked desk opposite desk with his nephew, Alan Unterman, Rabbi Dr. Alan Unterman. I'm still in touch with him till today. So he calls his uncle, and he puts me on the phone, and his uncle says, the minhag ha'makom here is to use May kidneyot. You should be matanetta, you can use it. When I later became a bit of a Talmud Chacham and learned, because I told you in 69, I realized I'll never make a living here. So I made up my mind, I want to know Kol HaTorah Kula. No, I didn't accomplish either. I didn't make a living. I don't call it Torah Kula, but no one can accuse me of not trying. So I saw with Rav Kook was the big machlokas, you know, the famous machlokas with Jaffo, and there were many mekilim in Poland, elsewhere. So I was mataneder, and there was a little bit to eat. Yeah, it was unbelievable. I remember one time an American came here for Pesach in the 70s, Chalamay, all the ice cream had made kidneyot. And this guy was a heavy guy, and he says to me, I don't care about made kidneyot. He says, I got to have simchat achag. We got to evaluate when is it the oraita, and when is it, then we don't even know where the minute we got. So I said, so be mataneder at least. And he was mataneder at that. So halacha lemaisa until today, I got hold of, I'm telling you everything, Jay, I got hold of Chief Rabbi Shai Yoshev Cohen, who's a friend of mine, and his wife, Naomi Cohen, we're both doctorates in American Jewish history. We know each other decades and decades. We know each other scholarship. So this is about 15 years ago already. So he promised me, I said, it's time if you, I said, the only thing I lack on Pesach is margarine. And I love matzah with margarine. Why can't it be made with cottonseed oil? In America, all the margarine is made with an OU, without, and they must cottonseed oil. It's not olive oil. Olive oil has an aftertaste, but cottonseed oil, it's no different than the oil you're using. He said, you're absolutely right. Tell me, gives Tashkoch and tell me. Gets back to me a few weeks later. He says, we can't do it. He says, Telma was willing to transfer their whole operation to cottonseed oil all year, not just Pesach. Once you're buying 100 tons of it, buy 200 tons. Eidah HaRedid refused to accept it. So Talma said, look, we must have that Eidah HaRedid Hechsher for business reasons. So I lost that. So you should know until today I use May kidneyot. I never went back because I have to have matzah with margarine. It's takas simchat achag. So that's the answer to the most difficult question. Outside of that, the matzah here is baked on a very high standard. It's probably better than any place in the world. The people working are all from, look, most of the matzah baked in Israel has an OU. It's exported as well. It goes all over the world. So I use Yehuda matzah. I use the Shmur matzah. I buy whole wheat matzah. It's to me, it's Tam Gan Eden. no idea how much I enjoy Matzah. I'm the only one whose my grandchildren were over, you know, over Yontifai. So all my family, and her and many of my grandchildren, all the families, different times, different. We had a wonderful Yontif Shabbat Saturday night. So Saturday night, my grandchildren started digging me. How soon will it be Pesach in your house? You know, they know how much I love. And before Pesach, the egg matzah here is Tam Gan Eden. I don't know how they make it. In America, the matzah has still a wallpaper taste. And here, the matzah, that whole wheat matzah, that, which you can use on Pesach if you're not makpid on Shmur all the time. And the egg matzah is Tam Gan Eden, that's all I can say. Which takes me back to my youth. All the barbers were Italians. You know, around the corner from the yeshiva was a big Italian barber shop. I once walked in before Pesach to take a haircut, and the barber says to me, "Do you know who just sat in this chair? Do you know whose hair I just cut?" I look at him, he says, "Rabbi Soloveitchik, you know who that is? I know who that is." That said the barber. So my barber where I grew up, Manona, Joe Manona, a guy Gamor, but a Catholic, you know, and he used to say to me, "What's that holiday? How do you call it?" He couldn't pronounce Pesach. I said, "You say Passover." "Oh, I can't wait for that holiday to come. The egg matzah that you have. Oh, is that something?" Baruch Hashem. Okay, now, today is a very important shiur and a very sad shiur. It's sad because, as we introduced last week, humans are humans. And I just want to show you something to show that I was telling the truth last week. I found it. Immediately when the Rebbetzin told the Rebbe that books are missing from the library, so the Rebbe called in a few of the key people. They turned to the Guraye family, turned to his brother-in-law. His brother-in-law turned to his son, stopped taking books, stopped selling them, and the son refused. Barry, the Rebbe's nephew, refused. He said, "These are mine." The Rav then, the Lubavitcher Rebbe then said they should get a show cause order that would not allow them to sell any more books. And I explained to you why they went to secular court, because a Beit Din does not have that power. And I told you exactly what the Rebbe did at that time is what the Rav had his family do in the early 70s. And I told you, and everyone looked at me, I mentioned the name Jerry Fogelman. Baruch Hashem, Jay Solomon could verify that there is a Jerry Fogelman, or was a Jerry Fogelman in the world. So one of the Rav, he just died recently. He was a very interesting individual. I have to say, one of the more colorful people I've met in my life. Would you agree with that, Jay? That's a good description. The Rav called him, as I told you, Fogelman. "You are a conservative Hasidic Rebbe." That's what the Rebbe said to him. So you know what I'm talking about. It works. It works. Baruch Hashem. Okay, so in the early 70s, he started publishing the Rebbe's Chiddushim. And I brought it to Tova. I said, "Tova, what's happened to you? Your father gave permission?" And she was hysterical. She called her father, called Murray Rebbe. And he said, "Immediately go to court and get an order to stop distribution. Here is the book that he published." Okay, remember I told you it had a green cover? Mibeit Medrashon Shel Harav. Now, it's very primitive, but look, it's like they used to send around the poems like this. But I'll show you how I found out. Where did he get this? Who put this? These were shurim that I heard, by the way. This is the Rav Sheyurim on Yoredeya and in Orach Chaim. These are shurim that I heard. Where did he get this? And you'll say here on page 53, there's Kainom Rabbeinu. That's what Rabbeinu said. But the person writing it, Avolani Vidaiti, the Ramah meant something else. And the Chen Hevin He Reish Aleph Chet Reish. And the Rav answered him, "I don't think you're right. The Lashon of the Ramah doesn't appear that way. Tell me, what is He Reish Aleph Chet Reish? Harav Aaron Chatan Rebbe." you know who wrote this? This is Rav Tzvi Shechter's notes. So he got hold of Rav Tzvi Shechter's notes and he published it. You can imagine when the word got out how many people wanted to buy this. Somehow I bought it the first day. Within a few days, there was a court order, and I remember hundreds of copies were taken to a warehouse. I don't know where they are until today. But these are Heschel's notes, and so you see with your own eyes that I was telling the truth. Okay, so that's... Okay, now, let me go a drop further. I thank Morty. Morty sent me a printout from the librarian who mentioned that Rabbi Levine was involved, Reb Shalom Dovdale Levine, that he was involved, and it's a lot of information which is subsumed in the present scholarship that I'm quoting. Now, we use the word that the judge involved was the son-in-law of a very famous Protestant theologian, and the Rav often quoted him, I believe it's Niebuhr, but I'll quote it. I'll have it in front of me in a second, but I just want to tell you, and the judge offered to recuse himself from the case. Remember, I said to you, I think that's the proper word. So R.A. Gordon, our Talmud from Los Angeles, he's a brother-in-law, by the way, to Nat Lewin. His sister's married to Nat, if I'm not mistaken, if I'm the Yiffus right. So he sent me North American usage, challenge, a judge, prosecutor, or juror as unqualified to perform legal duties because of a possible conflict of interest or lack of impartiality. A motion to recuse the prosecutor. So very, very interesting. And that is the correct word to use. And he offered to recuse himself, but everyone said, no, you can remain the judge. Now, I want to come back to the original letter that I quoted 2 weeks ago and quoted again last week. And this is very important. The original letter where the Sixth Rebbe writes to Alexander Marx, Professor Marx, please turn to the State Department and ask them to intervene and get my library back from Poland, which was left there when World War II broke out. A letter from 1946. So, of course, the Rebbe and his team of lawyers, Nat Lewin and the other lawyers involved, made this a central part of their case, that if the Sixth Rebbe wrote a letter like this, it shows that the Sixth Rebbe actually considered the library part of the general ownership of Chabad, not personal. So I mentioned to you, there's another side to the coin, and the other side to the is what the other lawyer said, that this letter really says nothing. The Sixth Rebbe was using good common sense. He recognized that if he would write to the State Department with the anti-Semites in the State Department, which goes on until today, by the way, or the liberal Jews who wind up there, who at times are worse than anti-Semites, self-hating Jews, ignorant Jews, a letter from some rabbi Brooklyn, Crown Heights, big deal, go into the circular file. But he figured if he writes to Alexander Marx, Professor Marx, JTS, this is already in the mainstream. It'll have more impact on the people in the State Department. So I want to tell you, my Talmud listening, who I've never met, a fellow named Chaim Schnitzer, I hope I'm pronouncing his name right, sent me one second, let me just check. No, that's not what I want. This is what I want, yeah. That, listen to this. It proves the point that I just made and strengthens the lawyers who were against the Rebbe. Why? I don't know how you come up with this, but imagine on the internet he found a letter from the Sixth Lubavitcher Rebbe, 1944, asking, it's a letter to the War Department of the United States of America, asking them to try to get an etrog for him I imagine it's from Morocco, which was the tradition of the Etrogan they used. And here, the War Department, 21st September 1944, in a letter to Rabbi J. Schneerson of Lubavitch, 770 Eastern Parkway, "Dear sir, this is in reply to your letter of 15 September, wherein you request assistance from the War Department in obtaining a citrus fruit known as an etrog from Calabria, Italy," not Morocco, Calabria, Italy. That's evidently where they had their chazaka, that it's Bilti Murkav, "for the ritual of the festival of Sukkot. It is regretted that the War Department is unable to be of assistance in this matter since the airmail service from Italy to the United States is limited to essential war requirements. While the War Department is sympathetic to your request, you can appreciate that any deviation from the rule would establish a precedent which would lead to many similar requests from various religious and other groups in the United States. I regret that a more favorable reply cannot be given. Sincerely yours, J.L. Elio, Major General, the Adjutant General," whatever the heck that means. Milt, what does that show you? The Lubavitch Rebbe wrote a letter, and may I use Mama Lushin, Zehav Oiskalach, from the Rebbe. They laughed at him. Mori, what a stupid answer, more requests. How many more Lubavitcher Rebbes were in the United States? How many more people were mockpit on an etrog only from this particular area, etc.? Okay, so I have to say, that document, had it been available, if we can go back in time to 1984 and sit with Barry Gurayeh's lawyers, we could submit this document. Wow, it would figure in the case. By the way, you should know that I totally agree with the ruling that the books belong to Lubavitch, not to Barry Gurayeh, but I'm not that impressed with the letter. I'm much more impressed if you knew the Lubavitch Rebbe, as we will see, who they were, what they were, how they lived. It's, to me, black and white. There's not even a Havi Amina that the books were private property. But that letter, which they made a frontispiece of their argument, with this letter here, wow, could you make a case against Nat Lewin? Let's go back in time and let's see what happens with the judge. Now, they're now ready for the case. Time is moving on. The lawyers are meeting. People are taking depositions. And Nat Lewin is showing up at Chabad day in and day out. And here you have it on page 392 from Talushkin's, Rabbi Talushkin's excellent volume. You have the source for what I think I already quoted. You see, this is the difference between a Johnny-come-lately Chabotnik and someone who has a little broader vision. The Chassidim around the Rebbe and the lawyers, Nat Lewin, he's a shame of Shabbos, but that's not enough. We have to turn him into a Lubavitcher. And that's what the Rebbe said, quote, "Let the lawyer remain a lawyer and don't try to make a chassid out of the lawyer." The original sentence, "Let the lawyer bleib my lawyer, mach nicht a chassid from the lawyer." And that's what I say to Lubavitchers who want me to become a Lubavitcher: appreciate me as a Litvak who has an understanding of Lubavitch. I am a chassid, but I'm a chassid of Moriah Rebbe Adon Yadon Yosef Dovah Levi Soloveitchik. Okay, but very fascinating. The Rebbe had a lot of insight. Now, the lawyer granted the request. All the books were taken to a warehouse. 100 books have already been sold. And by the way, all this information you have in what Mori Tarigan gave me, Mishpata Svarim Didan Mitzach, it gives you a list of all the books. It's very fascinating how much they were sold for, how much Chabad had to pay to get them back. But everything was taken to a warehouse. Barry had sold $186,000 for 100 books. The most expensive book was what's called the Kitzi Haggadah, which
each Barry sold to a book dealer in Switzerland for $69,000. The book dealer sold it to a private collector for $150,000 a few weeks later. Could you imagine? It's more than two times profit, 200% profit in a few weeks' time. In the end, it cost Lubavitch $432,000 to buy back all the books, in addition to $200,000 in legal costs. Now, I don't know. You're raising an interesting question, but I'm sure that legally, they probably try to get it back. But you would say, so the guy claims I bought it in good faith. The seller says I sold it in good faith. It was sold to me in good faith. Could be you could go into court. What you're talking about, of course, is The Golden Lady. What's that movie called that just came out? Is that the right title? Or something like it. The Golden Lady. It's the same story there. And you see what they went through to get back a painting that belonged to the family. So it could be Lubavitch was just expedient. Listen, one thing I've learned in life, I've had friends that have had serious lawsuits. Even if you win, you lose. The legal costs are overwhelming. It's unfair. It's unfair. But if you have to go into court and you need a legal team to defend you, it's unfair. It's a case of good friends had a business. There was a question whether when they gave back the business, did they clean it up properly, dry cleaning. And it went, you have no idea. It's been in litigation for perhaps 6-7 years already. And the legal costs, even the litigation finally ends, they have to pay hundreds of thousands of dollars. They've spent more in legal costs, I think, than what they ultimately have to pay. And this is a problem. So the Chabad was very smart, in my opinion. Buy it back, offers a little bit extra money. Maybe some people had a good heart and sold it back, just give me what I paid for it. But that's what it costs to buy back, over 200% what he got, it costs to buy back. Now we come to the very interesting part, and it's a very sad overtone here. And again, I repeat what I said last week. Unfortunately, humans are humans. And I've seen in life, within families, the enmity, the hatred. People sit shiva in two separate homes. It's amazing. Brother and sister, two separate homes. Two separate rooms. And I've seen it with Gedolei Yisrael. You know that a fortune has been made on television series on Hasidic courts where brothers are fighting. Take a look what's happened in Bavel. Okay? What is it? Bavel, one Bavel, and Bavel, what's it, 45, the other one? And what's going on in court? And look at the two Satmar Rebbeim. I don't even want to use titles because to me, one is a Machalos Shabbos. I'm still, by the way, it's absolutely true. They videoed the Fabrengen on Shabbos. I didn't believe it when I saw it online. I figured, Giddy, you know, it's Lashon Hara, Rechilet, out the Shtachim. You know what that means? To give a Shtach. Those who are anti that Aaron of New Square. It's true. They videoed on Shabbos. Brought a guy, a Russian guy, and he videoed. Got you. And you know what? Azafa Dortmund, I don't know. Forget my English. It is, how do you say that in English? Well, help me out, Morty. It's Fadokmkeit. Durchgenommen, the ganze Mahuspam, the Mensch, is durchgenommen. You become a self ego. That my Fabringing is so important that you bring a Russian guy. Imagine in Beverly Hills when they wanted to record me on Shabbos, the guy who takes care of the shul, the caretaker, he'll record you. If they wanted, imagine, I'll say to myself, oh yeah, what I have to say on Shabbos is earth-shaking. You got to have the guy record it. So such a self-centeredness. And, you know, that's the joke they tell. And there's a little bit of truth in every joke. That two Hasidim were walking, and one Hasid says, my Rebbe is fabulous, it's raining on the east, it's raining on the west, and where the Rebbe gate, the Vua gate, where he's going, there's no rain. The other chassid says, that's nothing. My Rebbe, here at Shabbos, there at Shabbos, Rabu Agates is chos, is noch vachadeh. So, I mean, it's frightening. But humans are humans, lo aleinu. And you can quote me if I kept it. Any ever said anything of wisdom? And a whole article just appeared. I have no muscle. An article just came out in Torah to Go for Purim. A lady, a wonderful lady, who listens to my shirim for years, and did a beautiful article on a little thought that I said years ago before Purim in the Kollel. Beautiful article. So I'm all up to blessing. I'm all excited. Wow, it's going to come out. People will see it. So I say to Rob Shaw yesterday, where's the article on what this lady wrote? He says, Rebbe, there's no money in YU to publish it. It's online. Telling me it's online, it's telling me like it's in the garbage. Who's going to see it? What's when, where? Ah, why? I wanted to give my grandchildren. Ah, you can't win. But you see, if I ever said words of wisdom, said this one out, it affected millions. Because to be a chassid, there are many levels. To be a mensch, an oiska avat a mensch. Again, it doesn't lend itself to translation. What Musa required, a person should rework himself. Maybe 1,000 people since Reb Yisrael Salanter was born in 1810 have followed Reb Yisrael. I'm proud to say I tried to be one of them. Yitzchak is one of them, I can tell you that. Okay, so now they're preparing for the trial. No, before a trial you have what's called depositions. Depositions means the lawyers meet, the lawyers from both sides, and they depose the person who may later be called upon to testify in court. And of course, with these depositions, you see already which way the lawyers are going to go, what case each one is going to make. So one of the people they want to depose, and she is deposed, is the Rebbetzin, Rebbetzin Chaim Mishka. Now, now you have Hasidus, you see, this Hasidim speaking. Both Rabbis Krinsky and Shem Tov were opposed to the idea of the Rebbetzin being deposed. They were aware that depositions, like court and testimony in general, can be unpleasant and not always respectful. And they were worried, Hasidim were worried. And I know I can give you an example. I had to testify in a case a few years ago. They sent a limo for me to the court in East Jerusalem. All the reporters were at the court. I couldn't believe it. I said, what are all these reporters? One flight above us was the start of Olmert's trial. One flight above. The court reminded me, one flight above. They weren't there for our case. So anyway, I'm now understand. So I got to tell you, I was treated with kid gloves. After the judge, Dobbins, Jim Kipper, and the shul that my children run. So we know each other, right from the Vikings. The lawyer for the opposition, what he flung at me, he says, I'm translating into English, he says, you are a first-rate Talmud Chacham, I wonder, you know, what's going to come next when you get a cut. He says, how come you said, and he quotes me in Shia from a tape a number of years earlier, word by word by word. I couldn't believe it, what they threw at me, because I answered him, don't worry, I knew what to answer, it's not a problem. But when you go, you don't know what's going to hit you. If you would tell me in advance, I have a surprise for you at the end of Shia today. No one in his right mind can ever guess what I have to show you. So unless you checked my desk before your class. But, you know, you don't know what's going to hit you. So they were very chassid. They were worried. The Rebbetzin should be subjected to this. Krinsky told the Rebbe they would do all they could so that the Rebbetzin would not need to give a deposition. To their surprise, the Rebbe was not worried over such a prospect. Quote, no, we don't have to avoid it. She'll come through with flying colors. You will see. Now, then Barry's team made clear they're going to depose the Rebbe. Here too, the Rebbe's Hasidim were much more worried than the Rebbe. The Rebbe said to them, you know, if they're so persistent, fine, I'll do it. Let them set up a date. Krinsky spoke to the Rebbe, and he said, I never, Rabbi Krinsky writes, interview, it says, I never would speak this way to the Rebbe. But this time, quote, I said to the Rebbe with all the boldness I could muster, it's not going to happen. End quote. I never said anything like that to the Rebbe again. I would never speak to him like that in the course of normal events, but I just felt I couldn't bear him consenting to be disposed and all the ramifications thereof. Okay. The truth is, the Rebbe was never disposed. In other words, the opposite case, Barry and his lawyers evidently wanted that as a bargaining chip. You got to know, too, when you have depositions and it's before a trial, smart lawyers, and that's a whole field today, a new modern Hebrew word. Can you tell me the word? Gishur. You know the word? Gasher. It's a new modern Hebrew word. I remember when there were headlines in the paper, the Baruch Lashon approved the word Gishur, to cross the bridge. Everyone would be happy in a civil case if the lawyers could reach a settlement outside of court, and then the court puts its seal of approval. It has the impact like a judicial decision. It saves a lot of time and a lot of heartache, and it saves the state and the judicial system a lot of money, as you can understand. So evidently, when it came to deposing the Rebbe, it was only a bargaining chip. That never came. But the daughters were both deposed. Obviously, if they're going to depose the Rebbetzin, they're going to depose as well her sister. In November 18th, 1985, she was deposed, Chana Guraye. She was insisted as the library was the personal property of the sixth Rebbe of her father. And Nat Lewin pressed away at her. Did you discuss this with Chaim Liebman? I remember I told Chaim Liebman is a very key figure. And you will see he acted illegally to save the sixth Rebbe and his wife. You'll see in a few minutes. Chaim Lieberman never married. So on that hand, it's a sad life. On the other hand, there was no one more devoted to the sixth Rebbe than Reb Chaim Lieberman. He was a very bright individual, perhaps too bright for his own good, when all is said and done. And he lived with the Guraye family, literally lived with them in the United States. He did, and he ran the library. He was the librarian, and you read about it in what Morty gave me. So you see, you got it through Wikipedia. It's an interesting document. He was the librarian. All the other librarians come after him when he's on in years, but he was the man, part of the family. And did you ever discuss it in Chaim Lieberman? And Chana Guraye responded, quote, there is nothing to talk about. It's my father's. It's clear it's my father's library. An inheritance belonging to my sister and myself. She revealed that she signed the document asserting, quote, by right I own 50% of the library. I give all my interest in it and my rights to the whole library to my son, Barry Guraye, as a gift. Now, but listen to this. And this is the saddest part of all. Now, remember, we are dealing with 1985-86, the mid-80s. It's not the 1950s. I grew up in the 1950s. The Lubavitcher Rebbe, I told you, something was happening in Crown Heights. Anyone could go in. Shlomo Kabach could knock on the Rebbe's door and go into the Rebbe anytime he wanted. By the 1980s, the Rebbe, as I said yesterday, not only is the most famous Jewish spiritual leader in the world, arguably, a Catholic may argue with me, say the Pope, he was the most influential spiritual leader in the world. I think if you asked Ronald Reagan, who was your spiritual leader, he would answer the Lubavitcher Rebbe in Brooklyn. It's an amazing thing. The Queen of England, Rabbi Jacobowitz, was her rabbi, was her spiritual leader. She related to Lord Emanuel Jacobowitz with more sincerity than she related to the Archbishop of Canterbury. These are facts. The Clintons relate to Rabbi Ganek. Whether you like it or you don't like it, Rabbi Ganek is their rabbi and he's their support. You don't know what the yo you went through with Rabbi Menachem Ganek came out in favor of Hillary Clinton. I know a little bit. Oh, did they get letters, calls, people threatened this, that, for the yo had to issue a statement. Rabbi, there's a difference between Rabbi Ganek when he acts on behalf of the OU and Rabbi Ganek as a public individual. Rakefit may be getting a salary from YU, but he's furious at YU for not selling Kahana's books and Hartman and Greenberg, every type of apikorsit of the most vulgar type. You have no idea. If you read the David Dubach, what I argued in my office with Dubi Hartman, you have no idea. How can you write this about your Rebbe? Beyond words, beyond words. People think they're bigger than God. There's no tradition, there's no Messiah, there's nothing we spoke about yesterday. It doesn't exist. Wow. So, let me not get all excited. So, here the Rebbe by 1980, hundreds of thousands of Jews are influenced by him. The man totally rebuilt Hasidus in the modern world. He keeps the hat business going, and you read about it in the New York Times. I didn't know, need me to tell you this. Do you know what Hannah Gurayi says? Testimony. With my father's death, there is no longer a Lubavitcher left. The only one who carries on the tradition is the widow. Kolzman Rebetzin Nechamadina, my mother was alive. She was the Lubavitcher Rebbetzin. Everyone came to her for a bracha, for guidance, with questions. When she died, there's no longer a Lubavitcher Rebbe or Rebbetzin. Now, what does this remind you of? Who can tell me contemporary American Torah history? The one topic I won't lecture on is Satmar, because I have a prejudice, a very strong prejudice. What? Don't tell me, God forbid. My Rebbe considered them Abikasim. The Rav considered them. He opened up the Rambam, Hilchat Tshuva, Parish Minat Tzibur. You demonstrate against the state, I'm quoting Rebbe now. You demonstrate against the state of Israel when the hands of the Gentiles are covered with Jewish blood. That's better. Don't say God forbid. Say that.
Say
Alex Glassman disagrees with the Rav. Fine. No, that's the Rav. I can't say
that. I say
I disagree. But anyway, be it as it may, Alex, you're entitled to your opinion, but you still haven't solved the problem of the Satmu Ruv being Mechalel Shabbos, the Parkesia, Bifneyam, the Eda. It is frightening. Wow.
That's not Rav
Yerush. No, that's not Rav Yerush. Two generations removed. I can't believe a parent would agree to it. Absolutely not. Anyway, no, what am I talking about? No, Alex, fill me in. When Rabbi Yoelish died, a very large element of Satmar refused to accept his nephew, the Sigit Rav. And who for them was Satmar? Rebetzin Feger. Right or wrong. Check it out with Satmar families. I know people. Tremendous picture on the wall, Rebetzin Feger. They said, this is our Rebbe. We can't identify with what happened after Rebbe Yoelish died. It's exactly what Rebetzin Chana Gurayi says. And how about your sister? She is not a Lubavitcher Rebetzin? It is the deposition. This is from the record. Chana Gurayi, I don't know. Do you recognize that your brother-in-law is the Lubavitcher Rebbe? Hanu Gurayi, I won't answer that. Do you consider yourself a Lubavitcher Chassidisha, feminine for Chassid? Hanu Gurayi, I held from my father. He was my Rebbe. And the present Rebbe? No. This is the deposition. Wow. And she describes, you understand, this hurts. This is Bifnei Am V'Eda. This is a man that had such hatzlacha in the United States. And I can tell you, I'm a litvak, and I'm a chassid of my Rebbe, and I'm a Talmud of my Rebbe. And the Rav, I have a letter in the Rav's handwriting that calls me a Talmud Ne'eman L'Rabbo, all right? I don't need anyone's heksha. I have heksha from my Rebbe. But I have to tell you, no one had more success in America than the Lubavitch Rebbe. You just think for a minute. The Rav taught in YU for 44 years. He raised many students. Some of them went on to be Goyim Tzaddikim. Some of them wanted to change color Torah Kula. The Lubavitcher Rebbe, just think for a minute, outside of Zalman Shechta, Zalman, what did he change his name to? Zalman Shlomish, whatever, Shechta, Shlomish, Shechta. I don't recall any other chassid of Lubavitch that went off the path. Whatever you want to say about Shlomo the Kalbach, but he remained a Torah Jew, all right? He had faults. But you can't say lower level, don't compare him to David Hartman, don't compare him to Yitz Greenberg. Don't make that comparison. No, Lubavitch, look what this Rebbe accomplished. That even today, Satmar walk with awe of Lubavitch. I mean, just think, the owner of Pomegranate, I told you more than once, built a domicile, a motel, a hotel, call it what you wish. When shluchim come into 770, there is room for shluchim to stay at this modernized, beautiful dormitory that the owner, a Satmar Chassid from Pomegranate, built. So they asked him, how does it come? How does it come to you that you should build for Satmar? For Chabad, a Satmar building Chabad. And you know what he answered? When I travel all over the world, they're the ones who give me a place to stay. I'm paying back a debt. I mean, what this Rebbe accomplished, you stand in awe. How many Balei Tshuva? I've been all over America, and wherever I go, I meet Israelis. I heard with my own ears, I hear an Israeli, the Lubavitcher, they're arranging the kids' bar mitzvah. So this lady says, you know, she says to him, they're speaking Hebrew, Florida. She says to him, you know, in Israel, we were in Frum, we were nothing there. But we came to America, and Lubavitch changed our lives. So, and I want again. So you'll say to me, but the Yordim, find the Yordim, but they became Shabbat Torah Mitzvah. And that means every Shabbat the kids are going to hear Lech Lecha Miyatzecha. Once a year they're going to hear it, and you're going to have a beautiful Aliyah. It's not massive, but it's high quality. Rakefet's witticism. America gives us its Tumat and Maisra. With all due respect to the Watsons, Teaneck is still alive and kicking. I would love to see them all here. But you have to be realistic. Unfortunately, but what we get, the finest, the best, Lubavitch, and here his sister-in-law is saying, he's not the Rebbe, and my sister is not the Rebbetzin. And they're saying it, Bifnei Am Ve'Eidah. Okay, I can go on and on, but this is part of the deposition. Nat Blumen kept on hitting away at her, and I don't have to tell you, it's the total opposite of the seventh Rebbe who viewed himself as a shliach of the sixth Rebbe. You understand? It's the total opposite. If anyone kept the memory of the sixth Rebbe alive, it's the seventh Rebbe. Okay, who published his writings? Who referred to Mori Chami? Who referred to him with such awe? Who made a fabrengen every year on the Hilula Yud Shvat of his father-in-law? And here his sister-in-law says, he's not the Rebbe, and my sister is not the Rebbe. Okay, now, it hurts, but what can I tell you? This is life. I know individuals like this, Lo Aleinu, that no one else is good, no one else counts. Mikriksich Medala, they're fighting with everyone. And you know very well, if the monkey in the cage, who's the monkey and who are the humans? Okay? If everyone else is a monkey and you think you're the only human, I think you have a little bit of a mistake here. But this is life, and this has gone on from time immemorial, and it will go on as long as man walks the face of the earth. Yetzer lev adam ra min rav, with self-centered, etc. And this was my answer. I might as well mention today, Rabbi Dr. Rafal Posendag. I was shocked when I saw the Modat Evel. I know him yet as a youngster teaching with me in BMT in the early 70s, mid-70s. And his son married Rav Heschel Schechter's daughter. They live in Israel, kind of part of Rav Heschel's children living here. And I remember there was a wedding, and at that time, I don't want to go into more details, and the caller refused to walk around the chatan. Refused. What a woman, subject to a man. Do you understand feminism? Okay. So the father from the kollel said to me, Rebbe, how would you deal with that? I said, how would I deal with that? It's the most important message that we can give someone under the chuppah. How would I deal with that? I would say, Morai v'rabotai, ladies and gentlemen, we now continue the ancient sacred custom of the kala orbiting around the chatan 7 times. Do you know why that is so necessary? Because our training in the yeshiva world and the world of Musar and Slabotka and Gadlat HaAdam, a man becomes very self-centered. We have to walk around them 7 times, corresponding to the 7 times in Kohelet that we have the word Hevel. We want to remind the man, don't be self-centered. It is vanity. You now have a partner that you have to take care of, you have to be concerned with. Your universe and ultimately become a full partner with you in life's journey. With all that you were taught, important to be confident in the greatness you can achieve, but remember to be humble and to be concerned with the lovely lady Yomo is about to marry. Alex, got it? Okay, I don't want to tell you whose wedding it was, but one of the fathers of the Kala, the father of the Kala, was asked, what happened to your daughter? And he answered with one angry word, feminism. That was his answer. Okay, but Rabbi Posen, Zeke Sadek Lebrach, he was a Panovich Talmud Chacham who brought and got a doctorate, was very big in Bible and Targum. He was issuing. An edited version, an explanation of the Targum Onkelos on I don't know if he finished it, I doubt it, I think a few volumes, you got to check it out, Morty, which volumes came out already. Chaval, the generation that I knew so well, disappears, and the new generation has to take over, and that's the way God made the world. And all we can do is inspire you, because you're still looking at a Jew who knew the Rav. And the Rav was inspired. I read about it in the Rav. He was inspired. He stood to a chazan who knew people who saw the Vilna Gaon. Okay? The Rav boasted about that. And chazan, read the Rav by my friend Rakesh.
So what happened with this kind of glory?
We will get there. We will get there. Well, we know she's fighting the Rebbe, but imagine if Nayam V'Eda, she declares, there is no Lubavitcher Rebbe and no Lubavitcher Rebbetzin. Now, then she tells the following story. This is the conversation that she claims took place. Barry was having some financial problems. Again, I don't know what the story is. I don't know what the truth is. Money, Oev Kesev, or Yisba Kesev. It's a delicate issue. I'm the happiest man alive. I have money for bread and water the rest of my life. All right? So you laugh at me. Don't laugh at me. I went through hard times in Israel. I told you more than once. I didn't have money for the fourth Shabbos of the month for food. So you're going to say to me, wow, you were lazy. I had 2 full jobs, but I was on the books. you know, people have different values. Could be in life, his children are getting married, he needs money, he wants to make nice weddings, has to keep up with the teenage crowd, whatever, etc., etc. It's a very subjective issue. So I don't want to say he didn't need money. I can't say he did need money, but he felt he needed money. So he came to his mother, according to her deposition, and now this is a quote of the conversation Chana claims to place with Rebbe Tzimchaya Mashka. Quote, I must have money. I would like to sell some sfarim from the library. And my sister responded, quote, you may take as much as you like, whatever you like, and in the best of health, you can do whatever you like with it. Quite a strong quote from Chana. Barry Guraye deposed, and he claimed half the library belongs to him. When Nat Lewin's assistant, the other lawyer, Shestak, said to him, Mr. Guraye, is it your contention that the entire library at 770 Eastern Parkway belongs to your mother and aunt? Barry then suggests. And the Lubavitcher movement has absolutely no right to possession, title, or interest in the books in the library? The answer, yes. Is it your contention that the present Rebbe Menachem Mendel Schneerson also has no legitimate interest or rights to these books? That is right. And the lawyer went further, and the entire library belongs, in your opinion, to two old ladies in their 80s to do with it as they wish, no matter what their whims may be. All right, this sarcastic question prompted his lawyer, Barry's lawyer, to jump up and to notice objection to the form of the question. Nevertheless, he instructed Barry to answer, and Barry said, that is my understanding. And Barry testified that at a very early age, he was a teenager, he was given a key to the library by his grandfather. Now, let me explain how the library worked. And this is in Talushka, it's also in what Mori gave me. It's a very interesting description. The library originally was housed in the large office of the sixth Rebbe. Nothing was moved from that room. That's where the library remained until this time. The seventh Rebbe had a smaller office where he had the library he amassed. But he wouldn't merge it with the big library. That was the library of his father-in-law. I saw this at Yeshiva, YU. None of you will remember this, I think. Maybe Charlie will remember. On the second floor of the main academic center, there was a room where Reb Mendel Zaks gave the China. Was that in your time yet? Okay, that room had an entire library in it, sprung from the 1800s. Why did it remain there? That was the library of Reb Fischel Epstein, who was the first chief rabbi of the St. Louis Orthodox community. That library was willed to the yeshiva on condition it remained intact. By the way, I taught in the room next to it. If you recall, the room next to it was a smaller room. Today they combined, today it's a big classroom, but they combined with that smaller room because I, after my second year as a Rebbe, I insist that I have no more than 25 students. So they always gave me, somehow they listened to me. It's like a miracle. And I look back now, who the heck was I? But I said a Rebbe cannot teach more than 25 students. And I had 25. One time I took them to 26. I write about it in Washington. Now, why is it important to say the library should remain intact? I was in Atlanta, Georgia, so I had a tour of Atlanta, Georgia. There's a tremendous conservative temple there. What a piece of property. The rabbi who built that shul was the Lavush Mordechai's nephew. Okay? He was the son of Rabbi Chaim Epstein of Chicago. He learned in Hebron, somehow came to America, may have gotten smicha from JPS, became a conservative rabbi, and I couldn't believe the awe that man is held in that conservative temple. He died in the, you can check it out on Wikipedia, maybe in the late 40s, mid 50s. His office is exactly the way it was. The door, nothing changed. You open it, the library, it's like you're walking back in time. No one's allowed to use that room. Now why? What's the psychology behind this? Very simple. I have a library, tremendous library, a valuable library. If I move on, no, they'll take the books, they'll throw them out. But who can appreciate, who can understand, who can comprehend? I have we published privately with a few friends the Medrash from Maisa of Reb Chetzel Lipschitz of Kalish, the Rub's Rebbe and Haradashin. I have the entire, no one ever was republished, just the Agada, I have the Halacha, the Agada. Oh, what's that worth to a Talmud Chacham, and it's bound, it's beautiful. Oh, who knows? But if you can leave the library intact, it's like the person is still there. You understand? It's like the museums you go to. Go to the Ben Gurion's house in North Tel Aviv. How many of you have been there? No one has been. Ben Gurion's at, not State Boca, Natan. State Boca was at the end of his life. You understand what I'm saying? But Ben Gurion's house in North Tel Aviv, right near the beach. Look at the library that man had. Look at the Svarim. You go to Adnan's house. Have you been to Adnan's house? We're now in the, what's it, the Amon HaNetziv, Talpiyot, what's that area called? At the end of Talpiyot, it's near Amon HaNetziv. You go to Adnan's house. His markers in all the set of the Zohar, all the Medrash Rabbah, 1,001 different markers. You feel the man is going to come back to his desk in a minute and go to work. Psychological. What can we do? Great people pass on, but what? Sixth Rebbe, that office was sacred. All right, but this is his grandson. No, how many of you have grandchildren? What you won't do for a grandchild? I told you the biggest compliment I got in my life when two of my grandsons, many, many years ago, I hear them whispering to each other, you know, the Yosef is saying to Roy, you know that Sabu will get us anything we want. And boy, did those young grandsons hit the nail on the head. Baruch Hashem. He gave the key to the library. What does that mean? Right, that's the library he worked with. He worked out of. His grandson has a right to enter. All right, but he uses that this shows that I had access. Always, I'm the grandson. All right. Now, the Lubavitcher Rebbe said something very simple. He wasn't deposed, but he said this after he heard the deposition and what Barry said. He said, I'll say it in English. I'll try to say it in English. If this is so, how come he came in the middle of the night via Ganav? If the books are yours and your grandfather gave you the key, and it's a family possession, why in the middle of the night? So you see, not so simple. When Barry sold the books, he had them appraised. Yet, you know, you don't have contacts with the way it works. You go to an auction house, or you go to some book dealer, and right away they're going to ask you, where did you get these books? And Barry gave various answers. The lawyers were able to trace. One, some old man in New Jersey died, left these books. I'll come back to that in a second. Two, the books belonged to his father-in-law. Three, to an appraiser who seemed to be aware of the family he came from, he said these were a personal gift from my grandfather. Now, saying that the books belong to an old man who died in New Jersey happens to be very apropos. In Russia, when you came into any refusnik home who had remained from, you could find svarim. You came into any shul where they had a gymnasium, you found thousands upon thousands of sparim. Tefillin. The last thing they needed in Russia was tefillin. What they needed was sofrim who could come in and fix the tefillin. Where did this all come from? The old generation died. No one knew what to do with their books, with their tefillin. The problem was, most of the tefillin were pasul. They had to be reworked. There was no one to do it. In New Jersey, Rav Pants once said something genius. You can quote him and re-quote him. When I came to New Jersey as a young rabbi, you could go into many Jewish homes and there were many svarim. You could be certain that the svarim belonged to the grandfather and the next two generations didn't give a darn about them. Today when you come in a home in modern America, Greater Elizabeth, New Jersey, and you see svarim, you can be certain they belong to the grandchildren. The earlier generations don't even know how to read Hebrew. It's a very insightful word. But you see, that makes sense. That he got them from an old man. It wasn't just a teretz from Baba, but people die. No one cares. Svarim, the old country, the old world, that is over. That's where I got these books. Okay, Barry defended himself. Barry showed checks. He said, why did I insist they pay me with checks? If I didn't think it was legal, the last thing in the world I would want to do would be to take checks. But to me, half the books in the library belong to me. It is a family heirloom. November 12, 1985, at her home in President Street, Crown Heights, the Rebbetzin was deposed. Barry's lawyers, Brian Colgan, Alan Hellestein, both of whom now federal judges, were present, Rabbi Kerensky, Nat Lewin, the other lawyers, Jerry Shestak, Seth Waxman, Barry and Chana Gur-Aye. You can imagine how uncomfortable the Rebbetzin felt, Chaya Mushka, being deposed with her sister and nephew. You can imagine her state of mind. It'll come out in a statement she makes. You can imagine her state of mind. She's one of three sisters. There's nothing closer than the relationship between sisters. With all due respect to brothers, they can go many different ways. Their relationship at best remains nebulous. Sisters have the feminine mystique, the feminine personality. There's a kinship. This is why when I went to Yeshiva Katana, to Yeshiva Salanta, which no longer exists, I don't want to credit Tsar Academy, which is Salanta, Akiva Riverdale, merger after merger, it's very different than Yeshiva Salanta of 70 years ago, to say the least. The Daila Hakim of the Remisa. So when I went to Yeshiva, it was very interesting. At that time, life was harder than today. Many women died in childbirth. Some of the kids that were my classmates, my friends, their mothers were really their aunts. And I later learned that it was Min Yisrael that when a mother died in childbirth, if there was an unmarried younger sister, she married the widower and raised the children as her own. And you can understand that because there's nothing closer than an aunt outside of a mother. So here there were three sisters. And remember, at various times, these sisters actually lived together. when the Rebbe, the sixth Rebbe, visited America, we said that the Gurayes lived in Berlin with the Schneersons. The other sister, Horenstein, lived together for many years with the Schneersons in Paris. Lo aleinu, the Horensteins who had come back to help their her parents who were left behind, and a lot of people perished because they didn't want to leave their parents. You just think for a minute, like the Griska Rebbetzin, the Velvel's wife, why wasn't she saved? She didn't want to leave her mother, her aged mother. Imagine, you have parents. Kolzman, I had the privilege of having my mother alive. My father died many, many years ago. But my mother alive, every day I visited her, every day I felt the responsibility. It's your mother. No one could imagine what Hitler would do. And these people didn't want to leave. The parents needed help. And as parents grow older, they do need help. This is the life. And this is why you have Kibbutz Avi'im. Because your parents did for you. The Gemara in Kiddushin, Daf Chavtet, on Rabbanan, Maizei Kibbutz Avi'im, Mashkeya, Machila, Matzil. What your parents, they fed you. You're an infant. I see my great-grandchildren. You have to feed them. You have to clothe them. You have to dress them. You have to diaper them, etc. And all you do is later in life pay back that obligation to your parents. So the Hornsteins went back and lo aleinu, they perished. And this is what was left of the family. Two sisters and one son, Barry. And now they're questioning the Rebbetzin. Nat Lewin asks Rebbetzin Mashka, after your father died, did you think you owned the library? She answered, never, never entered my mind, never. Do you ever think you own part of the library? Never. Did your, what do we have, some music? Did your mother in the, that's Rabbi Reuben, someone's calling him, all right, let it ring. It's an unbelievable world today, but you got to enjoy it. Did your mother indicate to you that she thought she owned the library? Rebbetzin Schneerson, my mother never mentioned anything to me about the library. Did Chaim Liebman ever come to ask you about the library? Never, never, never heard anything from him about the library. Your sister, Chana Guraye, did she cling to you after your father died that she owned the library? I never heard anything like that from her. Now, there was drama. What about what Chana testified that you said, let him take whatever she wants, whatever he wants? And the Rebbetzin answered, my recollection is different. Quote, my sister called me and said that Barry was in the study, my father's study, and he took a couple of books. He didn't take any manuscripts, only a few books. That's what her sister told her. So the lawyer asked her, well, what did you assume that to mean? And what would you say? If someone told you your grandson came to your library, you were away on a business trip, and your wife, you come back and she says, our grandson came and he took a few books. Well, what's your assumption? They borrowed a few books. We buy the shalom. A grandson has a right to borrow books. He'll pay, bring it back. It's not his library. That's exactly what she understood. And that whole conversation about Barry and the books that she gave permission, concurred, she absolutely denied it 100%. I definitely don't recall saying such a thing. She did testify that when she learned that Barry had gone in and took the books and went in secretly, and she was furious. And she called her sister and she cried out in what seems to be a combination of desperation and fury. As far as I am concerned, we've had a younger sister who died in the concentration camps. Just as she died and she is not here, so am I not here. It is if I die, do whatever you want. And at that point, the Rebbetzin hung up the phone. Obviously, it's a cry of desperation. Doesn't mean she gave permission. Every human being can understand it. Her sister perished in the concentration camp. Hannah has engineered this with Barry. Books are missing. Money is taken. She's no longer called the Rebbetzin. The Rebbe is not the Rebbe. All this has happened. The Eina Yisrael. And with that, she slammed the phone down. The Rebbe attributed her death a few years later to the Atmos Nefesh of what happened in the trial and with the books and Barry. It is so sad. She was later deposed and asked more questions, and she said, if you ask me who the books belong to, they absolutely belong to the Hasidim because my father belonged to his Hasidim. She turned to Rabbi Krinsky and said, at the time of my father's death, all he owned was his talit. Amazing, amazing thought. Even the house was in the name of Agudat Anshei Chabad or Anshei Lubavitch, was not in the name of the Rebbe and the Rebbetzin. And when the seventh Rebbe died, his only possession was the house on President Avenue, which I think was valued at, if I recall, $53,000, $57,000. That was his only real possession. His bank account was negligible. Anything he had, what came in, went out. Now, here you come to a very interesting question, and I alluded to this last week, and it comes up now in the trial. And I'll show you a footnote next week. Nat Lewin actually got calls. Now again, Nat Lewin is not alien to Torah. He's not a Johnny come lately. None of us in this room have Nat Lewin's yichus. His father, Yitzchak Lewin, his grandfather, great-grandfather, Reisha Rav, Aaron Lewin, his great-great-grandfather, great-great-great-grandfather, the Beit Shmelkis, the Beit Yitzchak, Reb Yitzchak Shmelkis, Dole Yisrael. None of us, as far as I know, had that yichus. I have some yichus I discovered late in life. I'm related to Rabbi Revel, but all right, that line I do have yichus. The Kalvarisky family, we're all over the place to Dole Yisrael, Baruch Hashem. So, he knew what's going on. No? Do you know that he got calls from Hasidic Rebellion? Nothing. What's taking so long? What are you doing to us? You're killing us. We own the shtibble. We own what's ever in it. Rishon, I gave you a very good example last week. I can't do better than Rishon. And I told you, I know Rishon at 8 o'clock. Gold, silver, diamonds. Right or wrong? My wife. Yitzchak agrees with the Rebbe. I quote Yitzchak, Rabbi Reuben says, ostentatious to the nth degree. Baruch Hashem. If they raise good children, I have to forgive them. But that's Rishon. I explained it to you last week. I don't want to repeat myself. So what are you doing here with this testimony? And I have to tell you, if you knew Chabad and you knew the Rebellion, to me, this is the most determining factor in the trial. It lo ya'aleo hadat that it didn't belong to the Hasidus. These Rebellion, total self-sacrifice. It's unbelievable. You know the Sixth Brother story. What he did against the communists, against Hitler, what he did to perpetuate Yiddishkeit in Russia, I can testify firsthand. The remnant that survived in Russia was entirely Chabad. Yes, then came Balei Tshuva and the result of the Zionist movement and the Mossad and guys like Rakefet. There were other from Jews in Russia, but they were all Balei Tshuva. Johnny, come like this. The remnant that survived were Meisa Nefesh, and many Chabadikim were executed. And many Chabadikim died in exile, Kolel, the seventh Rebbe's father. They were selfless. Not only that, but the Chabadikim were selfless. Not only that, I told you this. Think about it now in context. The seventh Rebbe, did he ever go on? Take a look before Rosh Hashanah, where the Vishnitzer Rebbe is, where the Safmud Rebbe is. Take a look. Go to Palm, what's it called in California, the nicest place in the world, Palm Springs. Do I have the right name? Say the weather there is unbelievable. The Safmud Rebbe, I don't know which one, what this one, that one. They wind up in Palm Springs during the winter. They daven at Lubavitch. Lubavitch makes a big deal out of it that the Satmurud has to daven in Chabad, Palm Springs. Herman Wolk davens there. I believe he just turned 100. He doesn't do well. What an individual. Wow. Palm Springs, no? The Lubavitch Rebbe, the Vishnitzer Rebbe, suddenly he's in Switzerland. Suddenly he's in England. The world can be shaken here, but Eddach can't be the Tatatut. They asked him, how do you leave Israel? My father would go, all right, your father went there with me. Different times. How do you leave Israel? How do you make a comparison? The simplicity of how the Rebbe lived. People in the house, I don't know if it's a museum today or not, but people tell me the furniture was the furniture. You know, really. When I came into the Rebbe home to start my research and to meet Mrs. Rebbe in the early 60s, it was like I was walking into a home from 1941. Nothing was improved upon, nothing was changed. It's like Rabbi Rebbe is going to come out of his study 1 minute from now. How do you even have a hobby in it? The Rebbe Lubavitch, very different, very unique. How do you even have a hobby in it? Belongs on a personal level to the grandson of the sixth Rebbe. Doesn't get off the floor. These individuals, this is not Rushin. It's not a regular Hasidus. It's unique. It's different. It's one of a kind. And to me, this is the most important factor, in my humble opinion. By the way, our friend, if I'm not mistaken, Shmuel Shilo, Professor Shilo, he testified that Hasidic cords belong to the Rebbe. You know, he looked at Druzhin, he looked at, by the way, Vishnitz and Sadigera and Babiana, it all is part of the Druzhin dynasty. There's, I don't know of many other dynasties, if any, that have survived on a, you know, a major level. No question there. There was a survivor in London, a Landau, from a very fine family, an uncle of the Nobel Yehuda, did very well after World War II. He built the Sadigera Rebbe. They say it's like a base, a Beit HaMikdash in miniature. But who does it belong to? The Chevron Yeshiva, who does it belong to? You understand? The whole literature tells. These were all family affairs. Bells? The Bells of Rebbe? I don't know. Check it out. But could be the Bells of Rebbe again. He may be an example where it belongs to the community. I don't know. It should be checked. Bells already is a world unto itself. ger. Who owns the ger shtibble? I don't know. I believe the ger rabbi owns it. Ger family, wealthy, wealthy. This is money the chassidim gave them. They invested in real estate in Israel. The Rebbe visited here about 6-7 times between World War I to World War II. It's well known. Like my wife's, Rebbe Mordechai, the Rebbe, visiting, his friend with Rav Kook, many stories. Every time he came, he bought property. Family doesn't need money. They don't take money from, they take. They raise money for the yeshiva, the educational system. But when you go into the Gemara Rebbe, he gives you an orange or he gives you an apple, depending upon what time of the year. Not you give him, he gives you. It's an amazing thing. But Chabad? Wow. To me, that's overwhelming. Solves the issue. I don't need letters. Letters, you can be my foul pill. I gave you a whole pilpul, and what kind senses sent me strengthens my case. But Shmuel Shiloh, Taka went and testified. That's what I understand. That if you want, no. These books, that's the Chalila. It is not private property. Yes, Jay, you want to go one step further? In the trial, to show
that the rest that the previous rabbi considered it his personal property. And then I just note that they had their hands on, there were a number of videos. There was an actual video record of the Rebbe's testimony, which apparently has been deleted ever since Bill Messiah was bought out by some Chabad.
No, it was not put out by Chabad.
Or was bought out by Reshma.
So I don't know why he deleted it. But to say that this was the heart of the issue, with all that's being said, all right? So here they show the letter, which shows that it belongs to Chabad. The letter I quoted from Alexander to Alexander Marx. So one letter refutes the other letter. But I would answer you on a very simple level. Yes, I have personal books that belong to me, my Kumash. I have in my office the Shas and Rambam that I took with me on the boat, carried with me, had it with me in the rabbinate, that has never left my hands, that Shas and you understand? So that you'll make a case. But if I acquire endless, I'll raise a different issue, I always get gifts of Svarim, the Talmidim and friends. No, who does it belong to? To me, personally, obviously, but if I was a Rebbe, I'd question whether it belongs to me, because you're a Rebbe, you see, you have a cow, or you have a deer, you put up. Unbelievable. All right, we'll pick up from here. We'll go further next week. And there's a lot more to be said, but this is the heart of the trial, the heart of the issue, and the whatever field Messiah has, but the letter to Alexander Marx is very powerful, but that letter doesn't convince me. What convinces me, well, but you'll see Eli Wiesel's testimony. It's very nice, but he doesn't hit the nail on the head, but you'll see what happens. And the comments and the results, and it hurts. My dear students, what did we do today? It's hard, the testimony, the deposition, the Rebbetzin, Chaim Lieberman, the middle of the night, the Rebbe yelling, Basi is Aganeth, if it really belongs to him, why is he taking it in the middle of the night? The sale of the books, the Rebbetzin's life shortened. I mean, you can understand the heartache, the aggravation. Her only sister who survived the Holocaust, and it has to end in such conflict. The testimony that the Rebbetzin, the previous Rebbetzin, was the last Rebbetzin. There's no Rebbe, there's no Rebbetzin today, and this is being said at a time when the Lubavitcher Rebbe has more influence than any other rabbi in the world. I'll go even further. He has more influence than any other rabbinical organization in the world. Just think, RCA, Ebbetus HaRabbanim, take the Reform, the Conservative. Who had influence? Chabad, and here his own sister-in-law denies. Okay, this is life. Yes, Natan. going to come to that next week. He supported the Rebbe, but we'll come to that next week. That's so, you're going to see next week is so sad. If you don't cry, you're not normal. You understand? I have a female personality when it comes to tea. I know I've spoken about this, but love, image memory, event memory, between a male, a female, but at times a male can have a female personality on certain matters. So I cry easily. Whenever you tell me a story of Balei Tshuva, I cry. Can't help myself. Because I was raised at a time everyone was running away from Yiddishkeit. Everyone. And today, so many wonderful people are running to Yiddishkeit. And we have to help them. I don't want them to be disappointed. I want them to see that if you're a Jew, you're a different type of human being. I hope I'm an example. I hope I try. But that's what we need today, because we have so many poor examples. But next week you'll cry, even with a male personality. Now I want to show you, I had a little influence on history. You don't even know what's in here. Yomo couldn't even guess in a million years. Remember all the years I say, Sempo Sugihara, Zeichet Tzadik Lebracha. And I always want to praise that Japanese man who saved me, Yeshiva, and my rebellion, my Yiddishkeit, my Yiddish. Everything I have, I owe to him. So, and I did a lot of reading, postdoctoral work was done on him, I have all the books. So, they finally caught up with him. And they said to him, why did you do that? Why did you risk your job, your fame, everything? And this was in Moscow. He was already an ordinary citizen, working in business. And he said, what do you mean? I had an answer to my God. And it turned out they could never find the reason. It's just he did good for the sake of goodness. The only thing they came up with was in 1938. Remember, he went into the bakery. I told you the story. And he met this kid who was trying to get money to go to a movie, a Laurel Hardy movie, arrived in Poland. And the father was short a few pennies, whatever they call it in Polish, zlotys, whatever. And Sempo Sugihara gave the kid the money. So the kid said, why don't you come to our house for our Hanukkah party? And he came and he enjoyed, he saw a Jewish Hanukkah. They say it's the only thing they could come up with. My dear friend Barry Liebman, who is the biggest stamp publisher in the world. So you have to ask yourself, what does that mean, the biggest stamp publisher? All right, America publishes its own stamps, Israel publishes its own stamps. There are countries that are not on a level to publish their own stamps, Grenada, other countries. So Barry publishes their stamps. Now you'll say, who the hell is interested? Pardon my, the rub used the word hell, so I use it too. Who the heck is interested in Sempo Sugihara in Grenada? You're right, no one. But it's a legal stamp there. But everyone in the world, including many of you and many of those listening, will want the stamps because it's a collector's item, Sempo Sugihara. It's legal in those countries. Anyone who's interested in Japan, World War II, Holocaust. Gentlemen, if you stand around here, I will show you the Sempo Sugihara stamp.
Very nice.
Beautiful.
I hope the family saw them.
Yeah, no, you'll see. He's the one who gave the visas that enabled them to get out. It's different stages of his life. The paintings are based upon photographs. Follow?
He was a tzaddik.
Ah, amazing tzaddik. What a tzaddik. Yeah.
And he got treated very badly.
Unbelievable. But we treated everybody by the Japanese.
He lost his country.
Don't ask.
Yep.
And there, this is. And here's his wife with him. She was with him in Kuzma. And she tells the story how on the train, when they recalled him, and he had to leave. He was writing visas on the train and passing it out the window and crying that he couldn't help anymore. What an individual. So that's number one. Her do the favor, get the hurt. This is, you got it. Now, freebies? Do we need another modern Orthodox organization? This is an answer to Porat. Very interesting. Very interesting. It's by the president of RCA. This is about the sixth Rebbe and how he left Europe with very rare, beautiful pictures of the Rebbe in Europe and arriving in America. This is about Lakewood, New Jersey, where they are fighting Lakewood in the neighborhood town because Lakewood is taking over the next community, Toms River. And the people there are fighting, but they can't win. These are the same article twice over on the Orthodox Jews in Israel. The ultra-Orthodox are now mainstreaming. But we got a bunch of idiots running the country yet. Imagine the Israeli army, I still can't get over it. They're against beards and they want the Haredim to go into the army. Wow. This is New York, the scandals in Satmar, robbing from the American government, two different incidents already being investigated, food lunch money and computer money. Now, if anyone here is opposed to Trump, all this is anti-Trump material, including the fact that his daughter-in-law does not dress theistically. So how can you call her an Orthodox Jew?
Daughter,
his daughter, pardon me.
Well, he announced that one of the speeches, he says he's very proud, he now has a new Jewish grandson.
And finally, this is an unbelievable article over Prime Kosher, the fancy kosher steakhouses, the owner. You got to read this to believe it, which leads to the next question. Can you give OU Kashrut to someone who's ethically unreliable when it comes to money, ethically challenged, we'll put it that way. I tell you, I can't believe all the problems that have come up. I also want to mention, I'm not going to be here the rest of the week, so anyone looking for me with a shiner, this and that, I'm going up to Haifa, we'll be back Thursday. I have three grandsons, two granddaughter-in-laws, and above all, a great-grandson in Haifa, and I want to visit them and see how they're doing there. So one has to be a good grandfather. And Be'ezrat Hashem, we'll manage. I want to thank everyone. The next week, Shirim. The one on Sunday, I'm just gearing up, is unbelievable. Yoma, don't forget to change. Yoma's mentioned. You've got to remind him, Rafi, to change the title of Sunday, because I never reached Rabbi Soloveitchik. What I want to reach is next week.
What should we call it?
No, I told Yoma already.
Okay.
Just remind him. And next week I reach Rabbi Soloveitchik on Sunday, Hail, Fire, and Brimstone. And I will defend Rav Schechter very simply by saying, don't yell at him, yell at Rabbi Soloveitchik. And he makes a footnote there, reference. And Monday, bring handkerchiefs to class, because the end is so sad, as you will see. And Natan's questions will be answered more than answered. And we meet again in health and happiness. Das Vedanya. I don't believe I gave the date today. It's March 28, 2016. Hello to all my students listening across the great universe. Kol Tov. Bye-bye.